You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back.
Welcome back.
So this is Leaping Cholla podcast, and we read Heidegger and talk about things. This is episode 4. We don't have much personal news to note. I think in the last episode we talked about the Jewish question.
For a child. Well, actually, and for us, we even discussed that.
Yeah.
Anyways,
yeah, but you said your parents were coming, and your parents came, and it was a lovely visit, but we did not talk about the Jewish question with them.
So it'll come up another time, and we will follow up.
Has to be continued, yeah. So that's what it is. We did talk a lot of politics with them, but that's normal. But it was a nice visit, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And so we're here, and we're going to continue reading through Heidegger. And I guess we should just start, maybe, huh?
Yeah, let's start.
Okay. You know where we are, right?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
3, of the event. The resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones. The last God. The resonating of bang in its refusal. The interplay of the questioning of bang. The interplay commences with the first beginning playing over to the other beginning, in order to bring the latter into play, such that out of this mutual interplay, the preparation for the leap develops. The leap into bang. The leap leaps into the abyss of the fissure, and so for the first time attains the necessity of grounding Dasein, which is assigned out of bang. The grounding of truth as truth of bang, Dasein.
Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. Nice little shorty.
Yeah, that was cool. The play and interplay was a fun play on words and playing.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. Yeah. I mean, we have this six sort of section headings in a way, or the six elements of the book. The resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones, the last God. And I think it's pretty kind of a clear, right, section, I think, mm-hmm. in a sense. I mean, there's a few things I wanted to kind of ask about. I mean, I think one thing for me, this word refusal has always been a little confusing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious. Are you looking at the German?
Yeah, I'm looking at the German. Yeah, Verweigerung is the word that they have translated as refusal. Let me see if I can shed some light on that word. Yeah, verweigern just means to refuse. So that's a pretty good translation. Seems to be pretty straight link between the words. So I think that this word refusal has always confused us a little bit. And there have been multiple guesses that we've made, I think, in terms of what he means by refusal, the resonating of bang in its refusal. And I mean, I think in a very basic sense, bang does refuse, because bang is not always there, open, available, dispensable, present. It participates in concealing and revealing. It gets hidden by machination, by the abandonment, by being, by all kinds of things. And it also can refuse to be appropriated, or can refuse to appropriate. So it has a, it has like a personality, kind of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's fickle. It's
like the female orgasm.
It's like.
Good. I'm sorry, I said
that's
that.
That's excellent. That's actually the second title of the book, isn't it? In Search of the Female Orgasm. And I think in the last chapter, he makes it clear that he's given up the hunt, that it doesn't exist. But no, joking. The resonating of bang and its refusal. Yeah, bang is like histrionic, and it's kind of having a tizzy, and it's a little dramatic. It refuses things. Like the female orgasm. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, terrible. That was excellent. I think that's a milestone in Heideggerian scholarship. The interplay of the questioning of bang. So the questioning of bang creates an interplay, and the interplay begins with the first beginning playing over to the other beginning, the beginning of Greek metaphysics into the metaphysics of today, or the post-metaphysics. In order to bring the latter into play, to bring the other beginning into play, such that out of this mutual interplay between these beginnings, the preparation for the leap develops. The leap of what? The leap into bang. And that's cool. Leaping Choya. That's why our podcast is called Leaping Choya. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons. The leap leaps into the abyss of the fissure. The fissure, what fissure? The fissure. The fissure between the first and other beginning, the fissure between being and bang, the fissure between concealed and open, who knows? And so for the first time attains the necessity of grounding Dasein, which is assigned out of bang. Dasein is assigned out of bang, emerges out of bang, and gets grounded by the leap and the grounding of truth as truth of bang, Dasein. That colon there says the grounding of truth.
Mm-hmm.
As truth of bang essentially is Dasein. So Dasein is the grounding of truth as the truth of bang, as truth of bang. So there's been much scholarship on wondering how to translate Dasein, what Dasein means. And it doesn't just mean human being. It means all kinds of things. But here's one definition, the grounding of truth as truth of bang. But I think, lastly, I think we want to remember these headings, the resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones, and the last God. I would say that these form not a transformational progressive ladder or sequence that necessarily must be followed in a particular order, or any kind of liberationist
map.
Protocol or map, exactly. I think they're just elements of our experience with bang and our discovery of bang and our attempting to overcome bang's refusal. They're just part of that journey. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
We made it through three. That was amazing.
Yeah, should we keep going?
I think so.
Four, of the event. Here, everything is placed in relation to the unique question of the truth of bang, i.e., in relation to questioning. In order for this attempt to become an actual impetus, the wonder of questioning must be experienced in carrying it out and must be made effective as an awakening and strengthening of the power to question. Questioning arouses immediately the suspicion of amounting to an empty, obstinate attachment to the uncertain, undecided and undecidable. Questioning appears as a backtracking of, quote, knowledge into idle meditation. It seems to be narrowing and hampering, if not even negating. Nevertheless, in questioning reside the tempestuous advance that says, quote, yes to what has not been mastered, and the broadening out into ponderable yet unexplored realms. What reigns here is a self-surpassing into something above ourselves. To question is to be liberated for what, while remaining concealed, is compelling. Should I keep going, or?
I think in general, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, he's obviously, he's countering the idea that questioning is a negating or a backward moving or a hindrance or a problem, that questioning should always be seen as a tempestuous advance, as he says, that says yes to what has not been mastered, and a broadening out into ponderable yet unexplored realms. And this is a self-surpassing into something above ourselves. And to question, the last sentence I think is lovely. To question is to be liberated for what basically is compelling, even though it's concealed. So liberated for that. So liberated in a sense of to then be in service to, or liberated to be given to, what is both compelling and concealed. So what's concealed is often left behind because it's concealed, even if it's compelling, but he's saying we must be liberated for it, and that is what we do when we question. Yeah, so let's hear it for questioning. Yeah, and, you know, I think we've talked a little bit about how, I guess we've experienced a little bit of the, how should we say, resistance to questioning in some of our contemporaries. I'm sure everybody has. Certain things that should not be questioned. And Heidegger here is saying we should question everything, which is, I think, in a way, a good, like, I think that's the spirit of our podcast, right?
Totally.
Even things that we might believe in or respect or find core to people we love and admire, we feel it's important to question those things just so we can be sure of them, I guess. Or even maybe not even be sure of them, but just experience the tempestuous advance and the broadening out that questioning gives us.
Yeah, it feels like often today questioning is seen as a threat or a attack as opposed to a question, I guess.
Yeah.
Or in a way, an innocent question or a... or maybe not innocent, but just to, like, also I think just in terms of like the idea of philosophy.
Yeah.
Being, it seems very based in questions.
Yeah, definitely.
And with Heidegger, like just the exploration of the many possible answers and the many different like variations and.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the hyper politicization of like public discourse has brought about a lot of sort of mandates and expectations to march in lockstep, you know, not giving any, you know, in a sense, not letting the enemy see the fear or the doubt in your eyes, you know, being so certain of your principles and positions that you're scary and that you present a unified front. It's all very military theory. It's very combative. It's very homogenizing and solidarifying. Solidarity is super important. And questioning just isn't good for that stuff. Yeah.
This saying yes to what has not been mastered is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice.
Phrase. It's like
that's really nice.
Because it's almost, well, it almost feels. I mean, is that I mean, I guess it's different than. Or I don't know. It's a different relationship to. What am I trying to say? To the question. Like, it's trusting in the process of the question, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, and I mean, mastered is a really interesting word. I mean, saying yes to what has not been mastered. So, A, saying yes to what you can't completely perform or do, to what you're not fully proficient at, but also to what has been rendered unfree. Something is mastered, it's basically enslaved. And so saying yes to the free.
Right.
Saying yes to the free. Saying yes to the contemplation and questioning and positions of others who are free, and free of your opinions, free of your views, and of your own opinions and views that are a little freer than maybe you're used to or comfortable with. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
All right, go ahead.
Cool. Questioning is in its seldom experienced essence, so utterly different from the way it appears in its distorted essence, that it often extracts the last remnant of heart from those who are already disheartened. But they then also do not belong in the invisible ring enclosing those whose questioning is answered by the intimation of bang.
Yeah, heavy, right?
Yeah.
Questioning is in its seldom experienced essence. So the essence of questioning is seldom experienced, he says. And it's so utterly different from the way it appears in its distorted essence. True questioning is so different from the way it appears in its distorted essence, so its false essence in a sense, that it often, true questioning, extracts the last remnant of heart from those who are already disheartened. So those who have already been crushed, dismayed, had their heart ripped out from them, their core, their self, what's unique about them, their individual comportment, their individual dispositions, their sense of their own history, that heart's already been ripped out of them. And genuine questioning literally pulls out the last bit of heart they had left. It's just so destabilizing and scary. But then Heidegger's like, but that's so whatever, you know, because they don't belong in the invisible ring, enclosing those whose questioning is answered by the intimation of bang. So questioning will be answered by the intimation of bang if you are able to persist. And I think, I don't know if we can answer it now, but I think it's interesting to ask and keep thinking about, who are these people who are already disheartened? And why are they disheartened? What has disheartened them? And what is their distorted essence of questioning? What kind of questioning is he talking about here that has a distorted, it's a distorted questioning that frightens the disheartened? We should hold on to that kind of thing and ask ourselves that at some point. Go ahead.
I mean, that makes it just makes me think of anxiety right off the bat, because that is, I think, a lot of distorted questioning.
Oh, but that's good. Yeah.
But we can also.
I would love to hear a little more. How is it distorted questioning?
Well, for me, with my anxiety, a lot of it is in the form of distorted questions or hyperactive questions of fear, or what if, or this terrible thing could happen, blank, or this, or blank, whatever, that there's just this kind of...
When you say they're distorted, what do you mean? Like
mutated, or like... Like they lack a wonder of questioning.
They're more like mangled and
really aggressive.
Yeah. They're kind of tied up all in knots and bent and not not really clear and open questions. They're more like they're more like tortured pileups, wreckages of question.
Yeah.
That aren't really looking for an answer.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's typical to
for me,
anxiety and the anxious state.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you know, I think, and so where does disheartened fit into that? I mean, are you disheartened because you're just like being barraged and beaten by these distorted, mangled questions that aren't really getting you anywhere, and so you, in a sense, have given up on the practice of questioning?
Yeah, I think that is the...
But then...
The danger.
The danger, yeah. So...
Or the
character. Then genuine questioning or non-distorted questioning. You seem to be excited by that, though.
What?
Like non-distorted questions. You seem to be you seem to want to try to find that kind of question
definitely.
And practice it.
Yes, it seems very
And that's why you belong beautiful. In the invisible ring.
Yes.
In closing those whose questioning is answered by the intimation
of
bang.
Because you want it. Looking for it.
Yeah, so you're not afraid of it, you're not resistant to it.
Well, actually, I'm not I don't know. Well, I mean, I try not to be afraid or resistant, but I don't know. I
don't think
that.
Of you as afraid of real questions.
Yeah, that's true.
At all. I think sometimes you have a hard time leaving your distorted questions behind and feeling like the real questions genuinely address your situation.
Yeah.
So like, you know, if you have a distorted question of like, oh, what if I'm going to, you know, in response to my anger, instead of throwing a plastic cup, I'm going to throw, you know, a knife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to throw my baby, you know, something extreme. Mm-hmm. And the real question behind that is kind of like, well, why would you do that or even think that that's possible when you've never done anything like that and you don't want to do that? And your whole organism has shown for decades a kind of a non-proclivity toward that. And so, and in a sense, the real question is, why are you thinking that? And why is that captivating you? Why is that enslaving you? Why is that holding you in its grips? And you always seem very open to that questioning. But sometimes it seems like you can't get a hold of it and really feel like it is actually a question. Like, do you know what I mean?
Oh, say the last part again?
But even though, you know, like we talk a lot about those kind of like, let's question these distorted questions.
Right, right.
But yet you can't seem to replace the distorted question with the question of why is that distorted question even there and why does it have power over you?
Right.
Like you almost can't get at the deeper question or the real question. Like it doesn't have any power. It doesn't seem to have any staying grip on you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the question, which why do the distorted questions have hold?
Yes. And you asked you asked that question with vehemence and genuine striving.
Yes.
But it often seems like you can't, what should I say? It seems like you asked that question, but that question has yet to be answered, doesn't it?
I guess so, yeah.
Although you're slowly coming up with slight answers, slight results. Intimations of bang.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
You're slowly having these intimations of bang where that question of the whyness of your enslavement to distorted questioning is slowly unlocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's concealed, yet it's compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate description of your experience?
Yeah. I think that is right. I think that the sort of real question has, I mean, like, what was it saying? When we go back to the refusal, Bang, and its refusal, like you said, it's kind of, the answer isn't always there. I feel like sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. So it's a lot, it's harder to grasp, or I'm just new to trying to figure it out. I'm a novice, so it's harder to grasp. So in absence of the ability to always have a handhold on what Bang is, then like, where does that leave you, or where does it leave me?
Yeah, that's right. And I think
Other questions are so dramatic.
Yes.
Like there's like more than a handhold.
Fanciful. Yeah. Yeah.
There's movies about them, you know? So, I mean, they're just their images and movies and,
yeah.
Did we talk about projection in the other one? I can't even remember. And projection everywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's just so much to hold on to. So
yeah.
Yeah. That's part of why this idea of the light hold is nice.
I mean, I feel like those distorted questions are being projected onto you.
Yeah, I agree.
In a sense, they're bouncing off the wall that they're projected onto, and then they're being projected onto you.
Yes.
They're almost like third party, or like, you know, the fifth bounce that they've made in space ends up on you, you know,
mm-hmm.
like they've been ricocheting all around and then they're projected onto you and you're like stuck with them.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good key into refusal, because if the intimation of these questions are answered by the intimation of Bang, they're not always, are they?
Yeah.
Right. The intimation of Bang refuses. It's refuses sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I guess it's not easily available. It's not always readily available.
Yeah. Oh, I hear the coyotes.
I hear them too.
Let's hear if we can hear them. I think we got one in the mic.
Yeah, I hope so.
We'll see.
It was a loud one.
We always stop and listen to the coyotes when we hear them here. I think. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that the solid grip, I don't know, of the distorted essence of questions. It's like very strong, I think. And so for me, the practice is to loosen it and to, I guess, see it as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we keep reading?
Yeah.
There's more here on questioning. I'm sure we'll continue to loop back around to these topics. Go ahead.
Yeah. The question of the truth of Bang cannot be calculated in terms of what has preceded it. Furthermore, this questioning must be carried out in an originary way if it is supposed to prepare the beginning of another history. As unavoidable as is the confrontation with the first beginning of the history of thought, just as certainly must questioning forget everything round and about itself and merely think about its own plight. History comes to be only in the immediate leap over the, quote, historiological.
Yeah, that's great. Really quick. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the questioning in the helping establish the beginning of another history has to not dwell on what preceded it. And as unavoidable it is that we're going to confront the first beginning of the history of thought, it's just as unavoidable that questioning has to forget everything around itself and merely think about its own plight. It needs to stick to its plight as a quest, and not look at what preceded it, not look at what's around it, but stick to it itself. And then history comes to be only in the immediate leap over the historiological, and that's a summary of, in a sense, that's a posit of the word questioning.
Mm.
When we question, we make history come to be by immediately leaping over the historiological. And as we talked about, historiological is, these are the stories we tell ourselves about history. It's not history, it's the stories we tell ourselves that history is. And so we immediately leap over it to actually make history start to be. Go ahead.
The question of, quote, meaning, i.e. according to the elucidations in being and time, the question of the grounding of a projected domain, or in short, the question of the truth of Bang, is and remains my question and is my unique question, for at issue in it is indeed what is most unique. In the age it is completely questionless about everything, it is enough to begin by asking the question of all questions. Do you want to talk about that?
I don't know.
I guess I just want to say that I'm not quite sure how we're going to handle it, but your use of the word projection is different than his use. It's like a totally different meaning. So maybe we need to find a different word for your use of the word projection, right? It's like the opposite, practically, it feels like. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not the opposite.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. I mean, did we talk about my use of the word projection?
I can't even remember. I can't remember. Did. I think you defined it. Yeah.
A projected domain. I mean, projected domain, I think, what did we decide projected means? For him,
I can't remember.
I mean, I think it meant like mapped or put forth or built or like a project, something set up for development. And I mean, I think we decided that projection also has a filmic. And Freud co-opted this way of using the word, projecting something onto something else.
Maybe that is how you use it.
Yeah. And I mean, projection also, we make projections about the future, but that's essentially mapping our current guesses onto future possible scenarios. So that it is in another way, a projection.
Yeah.
And a project, a project is something that we project, right? So yeah. I don't know. It's all kind of in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also seems like it's a pretty aggressive statement in a way. Not right. I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but. It seems that he's saying that this age that they are in is completely questionless about everything, which is pretty.
Yeah, intense statement.
Yeah, it's a big statement, but like also kind of really great.
Yeah.
Seems.
I would imagine it's probably pretty easy to live at any time in history and say that.
I'd feel that.
Our age. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's true.
But,
I mean, would you say that about today?
I'd say that about certain aspects of today. Yeah, certain people, certain arenas of thought and opinion. Yeah, definitely. Again, I think questioning, it can be dangerous. Questioning can be verboten. Questioning can lead to cancellation. Questioning is not cool to a lot of people. It's giving fodder to the enemy. But also I would say that, I'll get into that in a second. I think once we finish this section, I have something to say about projection and non-questioning so go ahead.
In the age of infinite wants stemming from the concealed plight of a lack of a sense of plight, this question must necessarily seem the most useless idle talk of the kind that has been opportunely dismissed already. All the same, the task remains, the retrieval of beings out of the truth of being.
Yeah, really quick. Yeah, I mean, in the age of infinite wants, so this is, he's describing his age, infinite wants stemming from the concealed plight of a lack of a sense of plight. So in our age, we have infinite wants that emerge from the fact that our plight of having a lack of a sense of our plight is concealed.
Mm-hmm.
This question that he's trying to ask must seem like idle talk, but it's not. But this concealed plight of a lack of a sense of plight is really kind of it's contortionist thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts with essentially saying people have a lack of a sense of plight. They don't have a sense that they have a plight, or they lack sensing a plight. And plight means a cause, something they must do,
mm-hmm.
a quest that they must go on, a burden they must bear, an answer they must find. So they have a lack of having a sense of what that plight is. And so in a sense, their plight, which is still concealed from them, is that. And from this stem infinite wants. So that's a little puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is, but I think we'll continue to expound upon it. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And well, and he says all the same, even if currently our age is an age of infinite wants stemming from the concealed plight of a lack of a sense of plight, we must retrieve beings out of the truth of Bang,
mm-hmm.
beings which have been kind of absented from us must be found again in the truth of Bang. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I've always read the concealed plight of a lack of a sense of plight is that it's a concealed plight to us, that like it's almost the fact that we don't realize that the plight is a lack of a sense of plight that makes it so we can't see the plight.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say that again.
That the true plight is that.
So our true plight.
Our true plight.
In this age of infinite wants.
Yes.
Our true plight, yes.
Is that our plight is concealed.
Yep. That our plight is
that we don't recognize it
that's
as
right.
a plight. And that plight is the lack of a sense of plight.
Yes. So the absence, our plight is that our absence of plight is hidden from us.
Yes. Yeah.
That's right. So our.
And we just, in a way, don't even see it as a, we yeah. don't even realize it's a plight, but yeah. it's actually our
so
biggest plight.
So we're living in this like triple negative of yeah. plightness, right?
Yeah.
A mirror pointed at a mirror, pointed at a mirror in which the mirror can't even see itself.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. If mirrors tried to see. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
The question of the, quote, meaning of Bang, end quote, is the question of all questions. As we unfold this question, we determine the essence of what is here called, quote, meaning, that within which the question as meditation persists, that which it opens up as a question, the openness for self-concealing, i.e. truth. The question of being is the leap into Bang, the leap carried out by the human being as the seeker of Bang, i.e. as the thinker who creates. A seeker of Bang in the most proper abundance of the power to seek is the poet who, quote, institutes Bang. We of today, however, have only the one duty to prepare this thinker through the grounding that reaches far ahead, the grounding of a secure readiness for what is most worthy of question.
Yeah, great. So, So I thought there's something I want to kind of touch on tonight. Can I do that?
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of make a official explanation of something that that excites me about this text, because it aligns and maps very concretely onto something that I am kind of thinking about and implicating into some my recent play. Mm-hmm. It kind of recently dawned on me that this mapping exists. So I wanted to kind of put it out there, because I think I'm going to be mentioning it occasionally, and it would be good to have it just kind of quickly spelled out. And essentially that's that this book is a lot about, I feel so tedious doing this, but I guess I just need to do it, don't I?
Yeah, yeah.
This book is about being versus bang, or the difference between being and bang, B-E-I-N-G and B-E-Y-N-G. It's largely an attempt to explain those differences and explain how those things interact and how they hide each other, and how one has become the occluder and the entrapper of another, and how one bears the truth of it. It really is about their relationship. Mm. And in this relationship, or in this little dyad of being and bang, being, I would say, is in a sense, as it's currently in Heidegger's view, understood, a corruption of bang, or a corruption of a lack of a questing for the truth of bang. So there's something suspicious, nefarious, kind of incomplete, or self-abandoned about being as it's engaged in today, largely because of a deficit of bangness and a deficit of questioning about the truth of bang and the intimation and being answered and appropriated into the intimations of bang. So this being bang thing is central to the book. And I think that one way to maybe contemporize, or maybe even mundanize or render a little sort of more daily and common this being bang distinction, is what I think of as identity and self. And Heidegger and Husserl and even Derrida, who was an expounder of theirs, use these words identity and self, but I don't think that at this point in history of phenomenology they had come to distinguish the two clearly as two different components of an intra-psychological existence. And so that's kind of where I'm interested in using the being-bang dichotomy as a leaping off point to get into thinking about the difference between identity and self. And I would say that pretty simply, identity links up with being and self links up with bang. Mm-hmm. Obviously, identity, like self, for instance, one of the most vague, undefinable words in the language. But I think, in a sense, a lot of what I want to talk about as we read this book is how to define that word and what that word could come to be and come to mean, especially vis-a-vis and identity. So being is identity, bang is self. And so we ask ourselves, so what I have come to see is that the difference between self and identity currently, as I see it, is due to five elements. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be interesting to see if these elements emerge in the difference between being and bang in disguised or Heideggerian ways. So I want to talk about those five elements. So mm-hmm. the difference between identity and self is essentially that identity is a structuring of the self using five active elements. And those, I mnemonize those elements through the word scalp, S-C-A-L-P. And so S-C-A-L-P, each stands for a word, and a way in which identity attempts to subsume, hide, subvert, suppress the self, much in the way being does to bang. And those five words are sameness, categorization, anonymity, labeling, and projection. So sameness is simple. Identity enforces the idea that the self is the same over time and space. And it struggles for and formalizes these samenesses of self over time and space through very strict and very delusional methods. But sameness is what identity fights for vis-a-vis the self, much in the way that being fights for sameness over and against bang. Being fights for consistency and sameness over time and space. To say something is the same as it was 10 minutes ago in a different location is the identity of that thing or the being of that thing, whereas bang would be a more event-based interpretation of that thing. So that's sameness. Categorization, just identity, like being, takes bang and puts it into categories and gives it a reality that is about the set or group or definitional regime that it belongs to and is not about its individual idiosyncrasies or its bang. It's just an example of a category. A is anonymity, and essentially identity renders the self anonymous, nameless, unidentifiable, ironically enough, through identity's emphasis on community or the subsumption of the self into other selves, and the service that the self owes to other selves. Labeling is just that identity labels the self, gives it markers, gives it little defining qualities that it must bear and that give it worth and value in an established market run by identity. Being does the same thing with bang. Things are ascribed being. And by saying that they are, they're given value. Whereas if they only have bang, they don't have value because they don't persist over time. Value has to persist over time. It has to grow. It has to be attainable at any moment. It has to be retrievable. And finally, projection. And we talked about that. Projection, mm-hmm. Identity gives the self, what identity does for the self is it basically tricks the self into thinking that third-person perspectives are its own first-person perspectives. In another way, it's like saying other people's thoughts become your own. And they don't just become your own like you just take them on and regurgitate them. You actually sense and believe that they are genuine, first-person, authentic thoughts. They become actual examples of your authenticity when in fact they're just projections onto you. So this is the difference between identity self. And I think, look, in what I'm writing, I'm actually trying to explicate and encourage and map a liberationist project from identity to self. I'm saying that I'm claiming that there's a reason and there's a preference for having a self versus having an identity, much in the same way that this book is claiming there's a preference for questioning bang and seeking bang over seeking an unsubstantiated being or a being abandoned by being.
Yeah.
And identity is, in a sense, being abandoned by being because none of the things identity claims have being actually have being. Mm-hmm. It only has being because identity claims it has being. So, and identity is definitely the lack of a sense of plight because identity becomes what shields one from a plight. And conceals mm-hmm. one's plight from oneself and then conceals the fact that one lacks a plight. Many people would say their identity is their plight, mm-hmm. but in fact, their identity is not their individual plight, and Heidegger really stresses that a person must have their own plight. They just participate in the in a group plight, or a manufactured plight, or a So this growth from identity to self, and this growth from being to bang. The book is about the growth from being to bang. I think a lot of what I'm going to be commenting on as we go through the book, and we have a long way to go, is going to be this growth from identity to self by dismantling and shedding these five elements, S-C-A-L-P, much in the way that I think Heidegger is trying to, and he's going to get into a lot of this, shed certain things like machination and worldview and non-questioning approaches to being. Mm. So I wanted to spell that out because I think as we go on, I'm going to kind of make reference to this stuff. So I thought I would kind of clarify it so it's there.
Nice.
Anyhow, I'm done with that. What, do you have something to say?
I guess I was just thinking, I feel like like you were just saying, that identity as plight. I feel like it's sort of, I feel like identity can take the position of plight to give a plight, to give a fight, to give a party, you know, like a camaraderie and a purpose and a cause. So it's just, I guess the question is that a true plight?
Yeah, well, you know, what I meant to say was exactly what you just said. Maybe I didn't say it, but I think that if the term plight between self and identity would be that's to have a self as opposed to an identity is to have a genuine actual plight.
Right. Well, you did say that. Yeah. You did actually. Unique plight.
So I think you're right. Identity. Yeah, I mean, say it again. I think you said it right, that the way identity becomes a manufactured or a fake plight.
Yeah, or it becomes I guess like you said, kind of a group think, a group plight.
Yes.
Which
is not a plight.
Is not, by Heidegger's view, a true plight. And it then further covers up the lack of a sense of plight, but it does provide a sense of plight, which I think, in a way, for as someone who myself who is trying to rid myself of identity, it feels like I've lost a plight by stepping away from the kind of current fights, the current war. So I guess it just takes me one step away. It takes me a step away, and then it makes me realize the plight of a lack of a sense of plight. If that makes sense, it is such a strong plight to stand in for everybody, for anybody, the plight of identity. So to let go of that feels like there's something missing. And I think in a scary way does open one up to the feeling of a lack of a sense of plight, which is scary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the way plight interplays between self and identity is really profound and really important to look at. And yeah, I think if I think what you're saying is that when one feels one is leaving an identity or attempting to shed an identity or stand outside of an identity, mm-hmm. you feel the plight of that identity leave you. Mm-hmm. And so then you don't have the plight of that identity.
Yes, that's what I'm trying
to say. And identities are plights in a sense. But they And I mean, I think, you know, I think why, where do we get off claiming that identity is a fake plight and self is a genuine plight?
Mm-hmm.
And why? And I think that, I think it kind of goes back to those five things in the sense that, you know, if you have an identity and you have the plight of that identity, you are a self having that plight as an identity.
Mm.
And that plight, which that identity is only constituted by the fact that that plight is in a sense manufactured for you.
Mm.
And you don't really control it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not actually fully contributing. You're not its sole contributor.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in a sense, turned you into its plight. It's using you. You're using it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Heidegger would say the nature of a plight is that it is literally what a self is. And as soon as that self becomes an identity by living the delusion of sameness, the delusion of being in a category, the delusion of being labeled, the delusion mm-hmm. of projections that are given to it, and the delusion of community that renders it anonymous, once the self goes through all those kind of distortions, then its plight as a self is gone. And it thinks that it has a plight as an identity.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's just now going through the motions of a general plight that is being determined mm-hmm. for it. And it doesn't really have, you know, to have a yeah. plight is to, and Heidi's going to talk about this later, is to be making, he says simply, to be making decisions,
mm.
right? And I also think here at questioning. So when you have an identity and you're simply subsumed by the identity that identity is, you are not questioning and you are not making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Decisions are being made for you and answers are being handed to you.
Yeah.
And so you've lost your plight.
Yeah. And can I give like a really concrete example?
Yes.
So I think the plight, and then I think it kind of fractures when the plight that you thought you belonged to you doesn't fully agree with what you agree with. So like, I mean, just to get really specific, is this bad or good?
No, please.
But just a lot of, I don't know how to say it.
No, you don't. I mean, I don't even know what you're going to say, and I know you don't know.
Oh, I'm not even sure. Yeah, I'm not sure how to say it eloquently. But just okay. So we're in the middle.
You're censoring
yourself.
We're in
the middle of an.
I want to point out though, you're literally. It's 2023, and you're censoring yourself. So go ahead.
We're in the middle of an Israeli-Hamas war, and I think a lot of liberals, or some liberals, especially if they are Jewish, were fairly upset by the liberal response to Israel being attacked and then Israel attacking back, and then the fact that most liberals are very pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. Did I say that right?
sounds good,
that example being that there was a fracture in the overall group position for some number of liberals because they didn't agree with the position.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if because of that, I'm not sure. I don't know if you can say that liberalism or the tenets of the politics of liberalism is a plight because it's so of something else. And I feel like if it can fracture that easily, then I'm just not, then it doesn't feel like a plight, I guess.
Why doesn't it feel like a plight? Because it can be fractured so easily.
Well, it seems like a plight or the like environment and the landscape of a plight, if it's a true plight, should like add up and should make sense together.
So you think,
not sure it's a great example.
No, it's interesting. It's very.
But I feel like that's where the politics and machination and the sort of worldview idea kind of all come together as well. When you then come across an example where the worldview doesn't hold together, I guess then it becomes confusing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the plight of the self always holds together because...
If you get to the true plight, yeah.
Yeah, if you get to
the true plight, I think it should always hold together.
Yeah, it has to because it's only one.
Yeah.
There's a unity. The plight of the self is the plight of the soul and the solo and the singular. And it is its own plight. And if one can get to that point of sensing or even having genuinely the singular self-plight, then there's no chance of, I think what, so there's no chance of, how should we say, as you said, it falling apart. The reason it can fall apart is because it has multiple parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the plight, the plight of the identity, the identitarian plight, is a group plight or a manufactured plight or a plight of many parts. And in a way I think that what we can say for that, not maybe having or gaining or meriting the title of genuine plight, is that under that group plight, there's the plight of each individual self relating with that identity.
Mm.
And so when the identity plight fractures, it fractures into little self plights. And so Heidegger, who's super interested in getting to the basic originary aspect of everything, would say that those self plights vis-a-vis that identity are self plights. Oh, listen. Then there's the dogs, the barking. I think another bang or being bang identity self is dogs, coyotes. So, you know, the identitarian plight is... It can't be a plight because it's... I mean, in a sense, that's the abandonment by being. Identity can't have a plight because identity is not a person.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Human, identity is not a Dasein.
Mm-hmm.
Dasein is self. Identity is manufactured being, machinated being, groupthink, technology. I don't know. There's all kinds of words for it. It's not a plight. A plight is a self or a Dasein facing bang. And identities... See, that's interesting. That's an important aspect of what identity does to the self. Identity says the plight of your identity is the most important plight you have.
Mm-hmm.
Join that plight. Join the march. Join the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Join the war for your identity, for your tribe, for the being that you've, you know. But that's a fake plight.
Mm-hmm.
You're signing up for the army. You're just a number. And you're going about your business, trying to win, not even going about your business, you're going about their business, trying to win for them what you will never have, even though they say it's going to be yours. Because really you're just a self, and the plight you have is that you have it is concealed from you. Your concealed plight, because you have an identity, is that you have no plight.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Identity is the concealing. It's a plight that conceals that you have no plight.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think it's the greatest plight. But in fact, you lack a plight because you've sold yourself. You've given yourself to identity.
Mm-hmm.
And yourself is plightless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've and you know very well, I've very much tried to link this up with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
This pattern. Primarily by saying that to not know your self plight and relate to your identity plight as if it's your plight, when in fact it's concealing the fact that you don't have a plight, is what causes anxiety.
Wait, say that one more time. That was nice.
To give up your self plight in exchange for an identitarian plight that is in fact just the concealing of the fact that you don't have a plight as a plight. Your plight becomes that your lack of a plight is hidden from you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what identity does to the self.
Mm-hmm.
That is anxiety. And, you know, I think, you know, we're going to get into Heidegger's use of the word angst and dread and anxiety and how integral it is to existence. But I think that the way in which anxiety is hardwired into the current state of things via the self giving up its plight in order to participate in a fake plight called identity, that is why we live in the age of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
We live in the age of anxiety for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know what the difference between identity and self is. So much of what's in our heads is identity, and so much is self, or self is not. Self is hidden and identity is over it, or identity is crushing self or hiding self, or we're relating to identity as if it's self and relating to self as if it should be identity. And we're back and forth between being and bang, being and bang.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know who we are and why we are and what we're capable of and what we think and what we feel. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes anxiety. And identities are handed to us, and self is not.
Mm.
Or in another way, identities are things we grab at, and self is what we use to grab. And so we confuse these things, and we don't know where our stability lies, and so we're anxious. And we don't know which thoughts are genuine and which thoughts are manufactured, and so we're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about, you know, the phrase identity crisis. I'm having an identity crisis. Oh gosh, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I belong to. I'm what I didn't think I was, you know. Well, that's anxiety too.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety is like, you know, in a sense, identity is the disease and anxiety is the symptom.
Mm.
And so we're trying to cure anxiety. But you don't cure symptoms, you cure diseases.
Mm-hmm.
We need to cure identity because it is the cause of anxiety. I'm convinced of it. I can't necessarily even spell out exactly why, but I'm convinced of it. And, you know, it's the cause of, and importantly, it's important to ask what we mean by this word identity, because we don't just mean, you know, a racial identity or a gender identity or a political identity. It's much deeper than that. It's the way in which our self has been co-opted by a regime of ideas that make it think things that it is not.
Mm-hmm.
that make it think it is what it is not. And that's, and so to think you are what you are not is at its core anxiety inducing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you approach every little moment in your life thinking you're one thing, but in fact you're another, boom, anxiety, right?
Yeah.
You know, you think you're a lion, so you walk into the lion's den and you discover you're not a lion, boom, anxiety, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, so this interplay and this dissonance between your identity and yourself, if you've given yourself over to identity, mm-hmm. which is really hard not to do. And in fact, it takes years and years. It takes a lifetime of unraveling and analyzing and discovering to figure out the ways in which yourself has been bastardized into an identity, you know, and that you've been rendered this neutered, plightless, hidden thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, also, you know, look, you also, you know, you start to react to things in your capacity as an identity, that in your capacity as a self, you would never, you don't even need to react to. They don't have anything to do with you. But when you join an identity, or you have an identity, or you perceive yourself as an identity, you become quintessentially participatory in all kinds of things that you are not, but then that then feel as if they are you. And so you become vast and disparate and multifarious, and you become engaged in things mentally, emotionally, stressfully, right?
Yeah.
That aren't you. They are your identity, or they have been projected onto you as an identity, but they're not you. And so all of a sudden you're just like, you're really like torn up and dragged into stuff that isn't you.
Yeah.
But you can't extricate yourself. So that too is anxiety inducing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well said. That is very well said.
And so, you know, and I think that it's a long, like, and Heidegger makes this really clear. It's a long road of questioning that leads to even early intimations of what the difference between being and bang is,
yeah,
or the differences are.
Yeah.
And it's a long road to figuring out how identity is operating you and how, in what way you are a self free of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you have to really go through everything you think, every historiological fantasy that you live, you know,
mm-hmm.
you have to deconstruct it all,
mm-hmm.
and figure out where its hold on you is, and where your plight is, and where it's been hidden from you, and how.
Mm.
It's a lot of work,
mm-hmm.
but if the goal is to live anxiety free, and I think it's really important work, because anxiety is like, you know, it's the great killer. I mean, it's just, anxiety is what holds humans back.
Yeah.
Anxiety is the source of grief and sadness and self-inflicting trauma and, incapability and I mean, anxiety is just, it's, you know, it's a sword right through your chest, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, it ends your run. Your run is over. Yeah. Like, your season is over. Season ending injury. Anxiety is a season ending injury, you know, and that season is like, you know, your adult life. Even if you become an adult at 4, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just playing around to figure out this difference between identity and self and have a self and not have an identity. It's actually, I think it's a cure for anxiety.
Yeah.
So what, I don't know, I've talked enough. What do you,
I love,
have any,
that.
Have any thoughts?
No, I don't. I love that. I think that's a great place to wrap up, personally. How do you feel?
Wonderful. All right, that was section 4.
Yes.
Of contributions to philosophy of the event. And we'll see you next, I don't know when. Soon.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.